Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here. Another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I am incredibly excited. I was actually just describing myself as a small dog penned in a room, running in circles, peeing on itself, because I'm so excited to have mom, wife, biomechanist, and author of Move Your DNA, Katie Bowman, back on the show. Katie, how are you doing?
I'm so good. I'm a little wet from being peed, but like, you'll spray me in your circles, but I'm good. Other than that, I'm great.
I restrained the knee humping, so I did have that boundary up. So
Small victories for me.
Katie, when you were on the show before, it was one of the most commented upon, most beloved episodes that we've had so far. So I am incredibly excited to have you back on the show. Give folks a little overview of what you've had going on. You've had a project with the Sisson, and in addition to the release of Move Your DNA, which Move Your DNA is out. What day was it released?
It was released. Well, it was. I think it's officially released tomorrow, or okay. Tomorrow from recording this, October 15th. But okay. We were shipping since September.
Gotcha. Okay, fantastic. Well, give folks a little overview of what you've had going on, and then we'll jump into the book.
Well, Move Your DNA, which we'll talk about today, is like it's the cumulative version of my work. You know, it's kind of putting out there these ideas of nutritious movement and what I mean by that, and the diseases of captivity, the difference between exercise and movement, all these big ideas that I've kind of boiled down into a readable book, which we'll talk about. But then also some of these spin-off projects that I'm doing are things like, okay, here's this broad idea of exercises and movement, and we need movement. And so I wrote Don't Just Sit There, which is, now that you've read this bigger idea, here's 100 separate pages just for you trapped in your cubicle at work. Like, what are some ways to increase your wellness there? How do we apply this notion of movement while we're still stationary? Because you can. There's like, movement is broader than moving your whole body around relative to the ground. And then touring. I just got back from 6 weeks in Europe touring for Move Your DNA, which was epic. I literally moved my DNA and the DNA of my two children under the age of 3 with me. And that was great. That was fun.
How are your adrenals after that? Mine would probably be like a raisin left out in the sun for a month. So
it was good. We did a lot of self-care. And we came back from Amsterdam, back to Seattle, where I live, via Iceland.
Oh, nice.
And so we broke up this 10-hour flight home, you know, which is very stressful, you know, very anxiety-making travel can be, by stopping at the geothermal pools in Iceland.
Nice.
And that seemed to be the thing. And Iceland Air allows you to hop off the plane for up to 4 days at no charge. So you can just get a plane via Iceland, get off. And my 3-year-old, you know, son was telling some of his teachers that he went to Iceland where there's volcanoes, and it was erupting while we were there.
Right.
And then that we stopped, and then we just took a bus. We just took a bus to this giant volcano pool, and we hung out for a whole day submerged. You know, and they have a green smoothie bar and a little place to get this mud and put it all over your body. And we just floated around. And by the time we got home, we slept on the way home, including the littles. We were totally chill from that huge trip. So that was great.
That's awesome. My next European trip, I'm going to do a hangover in Iceland for
you
sure.
Have to.
That's
you
awesome.
Have to. Yeah.
That is so cool. Well, before we started rolling with the actual recording here, I was talking to Katie, and I just said that I have so many kind of personal notes and questions. I've read Move Your DNA twice. I'm actually going to read another novel in between this and just ruminate on what I've been learning in Move Your DNA, and then I'm going to take a crack at it a third time, because there's so much great material in here. But I literally could fill up probably about 3 or 4 shows with questions I have from chapter 1 alone. And so I don't know how beneficial that will be for everybody, but I've got some ideas about how to go deeper on this stuff. But we're going to do kind of a big overview of the book and some of the material in here, and I'll sneak in a few of my own personal questions, because I want to get a few of those answered. And Katie, just tell folks about what this whole concept of nutritious movement and the diseases of captivity. That's chapter 1.
All right, so chapter 1 would be this concept that, in the same way you have nutrient requirements, food nutrients, that there's a broad spectrum of nutrients that you must intake that are essential, that would go into the essential category. You have that same requirement as far as movement goes, but that movement is really a broad category like food. So I can't just say, hey, Rob, you need more food. I have to speak specifically to the nutrient that you may be missing. You do that all day long and twice on Tuesdays, right? You are constantly reading over someone's set of symptoms, or you're reading literature and you're able to see, okay, well, what we know in hindsight, right? It's always, you're always reverse engineering. When someone is missing nutrient X, here are the symptoms that we see come along with it. So therefore we start to use food as medicine, right? So you'll say that you have symptoms X, so I know that you can replace this nutrient to get these symptoms to go away. Because food really is a medicine. It's like a baseline. We're talking baseline. We're talking about what are the essentials that you're missing. Same goes for movement. What I'm proposing here is that the category of movement is just as broad as food. And just to tell someone that they need to move more, or to think that you need to move more, while correct mathematically, the things that we can put in that you need more of would go into the category of food, they're not really specific enough. Because if we break down movement into loads, which I do in the book, so I'm trying to I don't know where I dropped off.
Sorry, folks, we're back. We had the internet gods hate us today. This information is so important; they're trying to shut it down. You mentioned movement loads.
Oh, right. So movement loads are the equivalent. They're the effects. They're the cellular effects. They're all the ways that your cells are squished and deformed, twisted and banged up based on the way that you're moving, and that those themselves. Your load profile, if you will, or load profiles, would have an equivalent in this nutrition metaphor. So that there are a spectrum of loads that you require baseline for just basic biological function. So that's what I mean by this nutritious movement. And then diseases of captivity would be, what are all the loads that you're missing because your environment is not allowing those to happen? How is our environment, specifically the house that you're in, the surface, the shape of the surfaces that you walk on? I'm talking about your mechanical environment, mm-hmm. The forces that are the byproduct of the way that you move, the shoes on your feet, the chairs that you sit in, and then the frequency with which you do all of those things, even the distances that you look with your eyes, at all of those. Our environment is very similar to a zoo-like environment for an animal compared to the environment in which that animal would live in nature. But it's not just what's around you. It's how you move through it. So it's the invisible stuff. It's the invisible effects of the environment that I'm talking about. So those are the two big theses of the book, is that we have requirements and we're not getting them, and here's why.
And you used a great example of an orca in captivity. And maybe you could mention, you know, like, you never think about, this organism evolved to go very, very deep under the ocean and deal with the stresses of increasing, aquatic pressure and then decompression, and that those stresses are actually, you know, baked into the cake and part of what is necessary for that organism's nutritious movement. And the lack of that ends up manifesting in pathology. And that I found that just fascinating.
Right. We just don't ever really think about, we don't think about the invisible. It's the invisible stuff, like the forces that are created. So with the whales, you know, you're looking at an orca and if you're like, well, what's the environment of an orca? And if you're thinking water, okay, that's one environment, but I'm a biomechanist, so I'm always thinking of what's the force environment? What's the mechanical environment? And water can create all sorts of different forces depending on how you're moving through it. And so we look at, you know, if you watch that documentary Blackfish, right? Mm-hmm. That was the horribly sad documentary, but SeaWorld is like, they're in water, they're swimming, like the end. So therefore I've got these giant Venn diagrams of water and swimming, and we've met the whale's requirement, not looking at, well, the whale would normally be moving 100 miles a day, you know, forward through the environment. And
instead
so
going in circles
and going in circles, and then all the things I list in the book, I get a lot high frequency of time at the surface. So in biology, it's not just what you do that creates a mechanical environment, it's also what you don't do. You have to consider that your structure is adapting to both of those things. So yes, like the orca and like many other organisms that are usually studied within zoos, we have movement nutrition that when we're missing it, we have a hard time performing basic biological functions, which is why species struggle, you know, in zoos. That's why they don't procreate well. They don't have a very successful live birth. They don't, those births don't tend to, the babies don't tend to live as long. There's many more infections, like all the same stuff that we have as a species now, except that we're all in the tank together. So I've tried to say, you know, what if all of the whales in the future lived in the tank, we wouldn't necessarily have this visual confirmation of the difference between a whale in nature and a whale in captivity. So all humans, for the most part, that you see, that you're seeing in your research papers, are in the tank with you. So your mechanical environment isn't going to be something that you're going to consider so much when you research, because it's outside of your cultural construct, right? Isn't everyone like us? Isn't everyone doing these things? Doesn't everyone use furniture? Doesn't everyone eat this way? So again, those are those big ideas in the book.
No, it's fantastic. And, you know, one of the, so the next chapter, the difference between exercise and movement, I think that one, particularly for a certain subset of the folks that follow me, because, you know, I'm into strength and conditioning, I do jiu-jitsu and MMA and whatnot. And so I'm always trying to figure out a balance between that, because I'm getting older, and so I need to really tailor the things that I'm doing towards, say, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, because that's kind of the thing that I really want to be good at and get some progress with. But oftentimes, the things that I know that would benefit Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, like just doing some low-level cardio on like a Schwinn Airdyne or something, one, I don't want to sit more. Two, it's so boring that I literally am just kind of like, I would almost rather shoot myself than do that versus. And then I look out my, you know, I roll my garage door up and I look, and there are these huge mountains and foothills 400 yards away from my house. And I'm kind of like, well, I could go walk up there, but then I'm not maintaining this heart rate of 120 to 135 beats a minute. That's going to increase the, you know, eccentric capacity of my left ventricle. And that's going to help me recover with jiu-jitsu. But I mean, this exercise versus movement deal, I see this really, for me as a strength coach, this tough interface when I'm looking at performance enhancement versus like life enhancement. And the life enhancement piece seems so much more valuable until I start butting up against the demands of, well, I wanted, you know, like I had a goal before Sagan was born that I was going to compete in the world's championships for age group Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I really, really wanted to do well at that. And then the baby arrived, my sleep got derailed, so I'm going to put that off for a little bit. But, you know, part of prepping for that would pretty much necessitate doing some reasonably unpalatable exercise and not really doing a nice broad plate of palatable movement. Like how, talk to us a little bit about the, you know, the difference between exercise and movement.
Okay. Well, so, there's two. So performance, athletic performance is of course an entirely different category than biological sustainability, meaning not just that you live longer, like, okay, yes, living longer, but I'm tired of that being the only parameter for, you know, like for your goal. Your goal is that you feel really good every day. And that, again, I'm, you know, as we're approaching this as, you know, us being a species, like what are the biological functions that you should be doing? Like, how are you sleeping? Are you eating and digesting your food well? Are you able to get pregnant and sustain your pregnancies, going to the bathroom, having sex? Like all of these things, you'd be surprised, because I work on the disease, the mechanical disease end, that a lot of people are struggling with basic biological functions. So we have to set those two things apart. That all being said, I do think that in many cases, athletic performance would be not only improved, but sustainable longer because of the context that if you're only doing exercise, which I'll kind of parse out as something for a shorter duration, isolated, like clearly if we were plotting you on a graph, this peak in movement throughout the day, right? It would be like 0000072, and then it would go back to 00000. Like that's the way most people approach exercise. So the difference between exercise and movement is those things are both, they're both categories. So movement is anything that you do with your body where something has changed position. It's the broadest possible category. So when I'm talking about nutritious movement, I'm not talking about this thing that we do called exercise. Exercise being a tiny, tiny, infinitesimally small circle within the Venn diagram that is movement, right? So you have a giant movement bubble and then you have a tiny bubble exercise inside. So there's a lot of different reasons that they are different, but the easiest or like the shortest way to differentiate between the two is that movement are those motions that you make while you are getting something else done in your life, meaning that you are not moving just for the sake of moving, where exercise is a really specific type of movement where you're doing it just to extract some improvement for your health. You're trying to reap the benefit of health through doing this concentrated thing of exercise. So like in the book, I talk about breastfeeding as being a movement. No one would put breastfeeding into the exercise category. And if you have breastfeeding classes at your gym, that's rad. And put that in the show notes if you have someone who's offering that class. But breastfeeding is a specific mechanical environment of the jaw that when you've done it as a baby, well, as a baby to anywhere from 4 to 6 years, sorry, moms out there who are breastfeeding, that it creates a size and shape of the jaw that can accommodate the teeth and accommodate other functions like respiration and breathing and speaking and the way that your tongue and your sinuses eventually work, that it's a load. It's a load that should be there. And that if it's not there, you have this adaptation where all of a sudden you don't have the space. Like, does anyone, like, no one really ever questions, like, why does every single person have to have their wisdom teeth removed? Like, why do we systematically have to have these surgeries that make our bodies more suitable for basic function like chewing and eating our food? And so this is kind of this recently emerged piece of information. It's like, these aren't the way that the jaws have always been, and they're mechanical. It turns out that your bones are kind of always being shaped and adjusting to the behaviors that you do. And so void of this movement, you don't have bones that fit your biological function. So that's really the difference, is the movement. Like, I get that question a lot, is like, how do I reconcile my need for movement with my need for exercise? And like, the first thing is, you don't need exercise. You don't require it. You do have huge epic requirements for movement. And a lot of those can be high intensity movements that get out your competitive yah-yahs and keep you peaked, if you will, for performance. That I'm not saying that that's not essential. It's just that exercise is not necessarily the way to go about it. And that when you're looking at research of exercise, you have to remember that you're looking at research of these isolated variables. And keeping that in mind, we are talking about diseases of captivity. So one of the biggest cellular biology pieces of evidence to come out lately is all of the cell studies about the movements of cells were done in petri dishes, two-dimensional. And they finally said, let's make a three-dimensional model of a cell. And it turned out that it had a whole different way of functioning and moving, that we've essentially been studying cells. Like, all our biological tenets of understanding cells comes from looking at cells in captivity. two-dimensional chained pinned down cells and going, look how they behave. And then going, you know, therefore, put your three dots, therefore, this is how, and then you work backwards to make all these theorems about the body. And they're all based on captive cells, which totally makes sense.
And
because
non-moving cells.
Right. Because captive cells are non-moving cells. Right. Like, why would your brain think outside the captive box when you are in it? And so it's really hard to reconcile some of the stuff that I'm talking about with, you know, scientific data, if you're not going back and going, you have to consider the source of your data and pinpoint exactly what it is that you're after. Because I'm sure a ton of you listening are after better performance. I am after better performance. Everyone is. But when you get sick, being sick is your number one thing that you're interested in getting rid of, if only because it hinders your performance. So this is, in my opinion, the way you go about it, is slowly stripping exercise out of your life and replacing that exercise with movement, period.
I like it. And I struggle with it all the time, trying to figure out how to make that stuff work. One of the things that I've done is instead of a dedicated workout time, I've been setting a timer throughout the day, and I shift between a standing workstation, a physio ball, and a regular like office chair that I sit kind of Indian style in. So I'm breaking up the patterns that I have, so that, because you made a great point in the book also that we have this data saying that sitting is problematic, but is it just sitting or is it just sedentism? And now if you're just standing in one spot, is that really going to be any better? And what are the problems going to be with that? So I've been trying to get a little bit of a diversified palette with that. And then I go up and just do either some kind of gymnastics tumbling movement in our kid playroom, or I have a couple of loaded bars and I do a little bit of stuff out in the gym with the things that I feel like are helping my jiu-jitsu. And then instead of just sitting on the exercise bike and trying to maintain my, you know, aerobic threshold level, I just get out and hike and sprint. And if it ends up being perfect for meeting where, you know, what my cardiac output needs are, I've been less hung up on that and more just focused on getting out and moving. And oddly enough, I actually do enjoy my life a lot more and I feel better.
Yeah, you know, we're all wrestling with these big problems, right? Like, how do I get work done? How do I attend to my family and my relationships? And also, how do I get food on the table? And how do I build a community? Like, these are all big things that a lot of people are trying to fit, but it's because they see them as isolated things, right? I have to get my exercise for these 20 minutes, which takes me away from these people that I also want to spend more time with. And so everything's in separate blocks. And the thing about nature is everything is in the same block. Everything in nature happens organically or at the same time. And so as you figure out, which I'm here to help everyone figure out how to make your life be also the time when all of the essential things that you need are happening, you'll start to slowly find that you can get all of the things done all of the time. So I was as a competitive athlete, like, I'm definitely someone who's competitive and my physical prowess has been a part of who I am my whole entire life. But as you know, there's this period of time that comes when all of a sudden you have little kids and it's like, I really like to go somewhere else to exercise for 2 hours, but it's not possible. And when you're the mom, it's even more not possible to disconnect, especially if you're trying to do all these other things like breastfeed 6 times an hour. Don't even get me started on that. So my solution was, okay, we don't have strollers. Zero, no baby devices. So we packed, my husband and I, our children, so they're 17 months apart. We pack them everywhere physically with us in our arms, in our back. We teach them how to do it. And in my mind, I kept going, I'm so bummed that my exercise, this was a while ago, I'm so bummed that my exercise time has been taken away from me by these children. You know, like, that's how you see it. It's like, these children have taken this away from my life. Instead of going, wow, these kids have given me an opportunity to carry 20, 30, and 40. They're 30 and 40 pounds now, respectively. And we pack them 5 to 6 miles sometimes. And
that's a pretty damn good workout.
That is way harder than anything else that I've ever done. And I've done some serious races, but I have to tap out of holding these kids sometimes. I have to hand off. You are so tired. It's like instantly going. You want to talk about your capacity for doing work? Try throwing an extra 30 to 40 squirming, having an opinion pounds on your body, and still try to move forward and up and down, you know, those hikes that you want to take. Or sometimes it's just to the store. Sometimes it's just a 20-minute walk to the store. But a 20-minute walk to the store, carrying a kid and packing your groceries, all of a sudden, I got my grocery shopping done. I had 20 minutes of close time with my kids. We did a family walk, and I got my exercise, but all within the same 20 minutes. Like, those would normally take me three separate blocks of 20 minutes. But right. As I've put it all together, I am, both my husband and I, both former competitive athletes, are in way better shape now, plus way better health than we were when we were exclusively training just for the sake of athletic performance. And we're happier.
Shocker. And then the kids get that enriched environment and all the sure. time with you guys. That's fantastic. And, you know, it's funny. I've been when I do go out in the morning and I try to get a little bit of movement in, Zoe goes out there with me in the morning and she plays on the gymnastics ring. She does the evil wheel. We do walks around the neighborhood. And usually Nikki gets up an hour or two later than what Zoe and I do. And then, you know, we're able to kind of hand off and I grab Sagan and then Nikki has some Zoe time and then they'll go for a walk. And we've been slowly transitioning into that because and it's funny because we were really in this kind of a paralyzed state where we were so used to going out and doing that block of time exercising by ourselves that it just never happened. And then you look up and you're like, okay, I haven't really left the house for a couple of weeks because I, you know, like other than shopping, because I work from home and all the rest of that stuff. And then we just started weaving more of this stuff in. We live far enough away from shopping that taking Zoe on a 4 to 6 mile stomp to get food, that might, there might be fatalities involved with that, for primarily mine. And then, you know, I might do the Hemlock Society final exit with that, but it's really interesting stuff.
Yeah. And you just, I mean, not everyone, you just look for where you can do it. You're always going to be able to find where you can't, but look for it where you can. And, you know, it's like, you're trying to figure out, like, what am I teaching my kids? And one of my big things was to not teach my kid to exercise. It's like, we don't ever say like mom needs exercise. They understand that we need to move, but it's more like, I will always say, oh, we need some food. We need some nettle. We need some berries. We live in a place where there's a lot of berries and apples on the trees and pears on the trees. So it's like, we gotta go get some stuff for breakfast. So I always try to make the motivation for movement something that has nothing to do with movement. So kids get, as you probably already know, or you'll find out, like they get bored, like, oh, I don't want to just go on a walk. Like, this is so boring. But it's like, we have to go find our breakfast, even though we're not going to eat the handful of berries that we get or whatever. I might slice it up on what they're doing, that the purpose of movement is something else beyond, I need to get my exercise, that it's just an organic thing that hopefully in their brain chemistry is like, this is just something that we need to do. We are going out to get water. Sometimes I'll say, oh, we have to go count all the slugs. We need to go find 7 spiders and put them in this bucket, because that would be a normal, typical childhood activity for a kid, is to go, you know, find your protein, right, essentially. And so they're participating. They're participating with their vision and their understanding and their natural world. And even if you live in the urban jungle, like, this is still something you can really do. You have to fake it quite a bit, but it's important. And even for myself, I love to take a walk. I'd love to go take a walk every day, but I try to keep myself from being motivated that way and instead go, what do I need to get done for work today? And how can I get that work thing done in a way that uses more of my body? So the post office, for example, I walk to every day. Sometimes I make up stuff I have to mail. I'm just going to mail you something. I'm like, I need to mail Rob this, nice, this clipping from my newspaper, and I'll slap it in and I'll walk down to do it. But in my mind, I have changed my motivation, so to speak. I was able to accomplish a work task, and then the movement was a byproduct, a natural occurring byproduct of that.
Nice. Yeah, it's funny. Zoe, for a brief time, liked, quote, going on a walk, and then, like you said, she became bored with it. It's kind of like, well, what do we do? And then I said, hey, Zoe, we need to go catch some lizards. And she was like, right on. And yeah. So then it's either lizard catching, or if we do head over to the Truckee River, which isn't far from the house, then we catch crawdads. And so I've got a bucket in the car, and we just, we both wear shorts, and I've got some, both of us have shoes on that we can go in and out of the water, and we go catch some crawdads, and lo and behold, we get some exercise, some movement, however you want to characterize it, but we're both out, and she's just enthralled with that stuff, and so am I. It's a ton of fun.
Yeah, it is fun. It's a great way to put your parenting time with your movement time, you know?
Right. So, you know, your chapter 4, where you talk about hemodynamics and why we may not need cardio, I think that some folks are going to read that and they're going to keel over and die just even looking at that. Like, what's the story with that? With that? And you do a wonderful job of really making that case with vascularization and non-laminar flow and whatnot. But walk folks through that one. I think they'll find it really interesting.
Well, I mean, I guess the words are like need. Like throughout a historical timeline, cardio, like needing cardio, it would be that to isolate this idea that getting your heart rate up for the sake of getting your heart rate up is something that's essential for human function.
Right.
So that's what that post is really about. Because I think that most people will say, you know, it's like, okay, great, I understand, I need to mobilize, I need to move. But what about my heart? Don't I need to make my heart stronger? Because we just have this way of understanding the way what's going on with our cardiovascular system. So like, who wants a healthy cardiovascular system? I do. Everyone's hand up. What does the cardiovascular system do again? And then everyone has their answer. And their answer is something to the effect of, my cardiovascular system is responsible for, you know, bringing oxygen in to my mouth and nose, and then getting that oxygen in through the lungs to the blood, and then distributing that oxygen, and then repeat, repeat, repeat. And it's like, great, how do we know when our cardiovascular system isn't functioning well? And everyone's answer is, because I have a problem getting my heart rate up. I have a problem sustaining my heart rate. So what happens is, you have a very closed rationale system of why you need cardiovascular exercise. How your heart rate, the height, I want to say height, the amount that you can get it up to, and the amount that you can sustain it, and the time over which you can bring it back down, is our way of understanding if we have a functioning cardiovascular system or not. But what I'm trying to explain in the book is, oxygen delivery does not happen within this heart artery system that you picture when you think back to your textbooks, that the end user, if you will, of your cardiovascular system are the individual cells themselves. That the whole reason you have a cardiovascular system is to be able to bring red blood cells to the individual cells for fuel, for breathing, not just fuel, for breathing. So you are one organism that's breathing, but you are made of a trillion tiny organisms that are also breathing. So my question is, how well are all trillion of you breathing? And the answer is very poorly. You have cellular death happening all over your body. And that cellular death is a better indication of your cardiovascular function than what you're measuring, which is your VO2 output or your heart rate or how fast you can bring it down. That if you want a healthy cardiovascular system, the result that you would be looking for is that you are free of cellular disease. And pretty much every disease you have is some sort of failure in the cellular feeding or the cellular replication process. So that's what that book is about. So a lot of people have very poor. So when you exercise, I think the belief is I'm exercising, my heart rate's up, all my cells are being fed, but that's not the case. The only parts of you that increased in circulation are the very small parts of you that are working. And it would be, if you're like, okay, so I'm, you know, riding my bike or I'm doing whatever, I'm trying to think of another exercise, I'm running or whatever, only the parts of you that are articulating is this increased blood flow happening through. And then to make it even a little bit more, to add another layer onto it, is just because you see your arm and leg moving doesn't necessarily mean that that arm and leg is moving freely, in which case you would have this vasodilation, right, which is the opening of the blood vessels, the arterioles, the smaller ones, to pull the blood out of your arteries. You have to get your blood out of your arteries. What do you need to be able to do that? You have to have supple arterial walls. What do you need to have that? You have to have supple muscle, and which requires a regular muscle use around those areas. So there's a lot of very stiff people who have chair baggage, right? Which is cellular adaptations to being immobile, not just throughout the day, but throughout most of their life, mm-hmm. that when they're going to do their exercise are not vasodilating. They're vasodilating in really tiny areas throughout their body. So they've essentially increased this speed, and they've changed the velocity of the blood, and that there's this whole other element of movement and interaction that's happening on your cellular level that might not be in the health making way. And that before you just go to cardio, you should do a head to toe analysis of how much of my body would be vasodilating in response to cardio. So I have a friend who's currently getting his degree in biomechanics. And so he's done a lot of training with me, and he's, you know, at the university, and he's talking to his biomechanics, and they're still teaching in the kinesiology department that the vasodilation at the onset of exercise is chemically induced, which was a disproven theory, you know, back 10 years ago. But it's still kind of everyone's understanding is that you start exercise, and that there's a cascade of chemicals that causes vasodilation, which would make sense that it's more systemic, but it's not. The vasodilation response is triggered by the stimulation, the active contraction of the muscles that are participating. And so your bout of exercise isn't improving the cardiovascular system for the purpose of distributing oxygen head to toe throughout all of your cells, so that all of your cells regenerate and breathe at about the same rate, which is what you want. Disease is when you have that discrepancy, when you've got some cells breathing, but some cells next door not breathing at the same rate. You end up getting stress risers, mechanically speaking, or mechanical engineer points of failure within mm-hmm. the body. So that's what that section about is, not that you don't need to be doing intense movements throughout your life. It's just the way that we do them and the context in which we're doing them, I think, is ignoring a lot of biologically plausible and basic mechanical understandings of how arterial plaque is laid down in the body, and that you're just constantly referring back to the closed system of that I know my heart rate is good because my heart rate is up, and so therefore my heart rate is good. Like you're using the own variables within the system instead of going, how can you actually tell that your cardiovascular system is performing well? What are you after for your cardiovascular system? And then just make sure that your movement practice is matching up what you want your body to be doing for now and in the future.
You went through the morphological changes that occur from sitting and how that carries over into the standing position. And you have some, later in the book, you go through some methodology for undoing that. But I think, you know, even for me, like I see, I had never really sat that much. Like in school, clearly I did, but we ran a gym for years, and I was on my feet all day long. I was squatting constantly, stretching. You know, I had a really quite diversified movement pool. And then I started blogging, and then I wrote a book, and then I started traveling with, you know, 16-hour days sitting on an airplane and whatnot. And the effects it had on my low back and my knees were catastrophic. And it's taken quite a bit of time to undo that. And it's been interesting also that as that stuff kind of got buggered up, it was really, really hard to just maintain my base, like what I would consider like the youthful aerobic level. You know, like when you're really young, it just seems like you've got cardio almost no matter what you do. And I think that maybe that's because you're tumbling and lunging and running around and just doing stuff. So your base level of activity is really good, but also your just movement is good. You know, I think is possibly what I took from what you were saying is that when you are free of these adhesions and these movement restrictions and whatnot, then everything is just functioning at a much more efficient level.
Yeah, like we always think like, hey, I'm moving over the ground. I'm moving. It's like, again, you have to think of yourself as trillions of parts. And while you might be carrying on with your day, with your exercise or with whatever you're doing, less and less of you is participating over time. And that's the way that I'm trying to help people see their body as a sum of many parts. And I'm not talking about like your stomach and your liver and your elbow. And like, I'm not talking about those kind of parts. I'm talking about all the cellular structures that make you up are slowly kind of, are they dying off or they are inert. While you are moving, they are still because of some of the, like it, still meaning not being compressed or deformed or squashed or squished by the gravitational load, that these, even these loads that are constant like gravity, through your habits, through your adaptations to your habits, you've modified what the cells are actually receiving. And that's kind of, you know, we talk about mobility for athletic performance and for better knees and for better backs, but mobility, when you are mobile, meaning all of your hinges articulate, which then of course has a component. If your hinge is articulating, then the muscles attached to that hinge are able to move through their ranges of motion. Then that's when you recognize that that movement of that part of that hinge translates into movement of the muscles that attach to that hinge, which translates into oxygen and red blood cells coming into that local area. You begin to understand that movement has a localized effect. And so you have to be moving in a way that distributes nourishment evenly throughout the whole entire body. And variability and being exposed to lots of different motions is one way to get that. You know, you talk about cross training, right? Everyone cross trains, right? Everyone recognizes that you got to do at least three or four things. Yeah.
Unless you're an Olympic lifter, in which case you do Olympic lifting and then you ride a golf cart to your Olympic lifting platform because it's too fatiguing to walk. Right. But yeah.
So I would say most people go, okay, yeah, I understand that, like, except in the most hardcore extreme
situation
where it would negatively influence your performance, right? So about the performance, that you would have to cross train. But what I'm saying is our notion of cross training is like you're thinking of 12 different things that you need to do when there were actually 3 billion. Like there were 3 billion different loads, because everything, when I say thing you're doing, I'm talking about, you know, what's the cellular squish. So if you go out and you're like, but I run, you know, let's say that you run or you walk, you go different distances, or you're doing your heart rate, you're playing with variability in all sense of what you found in, you know, conditioning literature, but you didn't recognize that every single step or run or whatever thing that you've ever done has been on flat and level ground. So you're already missing flat and level ground being the almost never occurring environment for your foot and therefore the rest of your body. The geometry that you assume every single day would almost never occur in nature, and yet it is your most frequently consumed vitamin. So you're going, wow, okay. So if I can give you a million different surfaces on your foot and therefore a million different whole body positions because of this surface, then your idea of cross training really wasn't coming close to what I'm talking about, which is you've got these huge ranges of cells that have never participated in your movement because they've essentially been casted by your environment, your shoes, the flat and level ground. So any exercise that you're doing, but on the flat and level ground would have to be modified. The distance that you look at stuff with your eyes, which is, you know, 3 to 30 feet, pretty much your whole entire life, never looked really beyond that. Besides these little isolated, you know, camping trips or whatever for the most. So there's so many different ways in which we're casted. You're casted by the belt that you put on your pants every day and the chair that you sit in and the couch and the car that you drive. But that over time, these not only limit your physical experiences, but then they start to shape your mental ones as well. So then we take this construct of how it is and we put it on the next generation sooner, and we build these things in that we do. That's kind of how a meme goes, right? You take an idea and it becomes some physical expression because now you can't even get a car seat without a bucket seat. Like, when did that happen? When did car manufacturers decide that no one should be able to sit in anything but a slouched, flexed back position because it was more comfortable for the people who had sat that before? So now you put your kid in the car, your kid's in a bucket, and then they transfer out of that bucket and they go into the bucket seat of your car. And now their preference will always be for a bucket because their bodies have been molded to the cultural furniture design that came from someone's mind at some point. And now you have bodies being shaped by beliefs, which then perpetuate the body and the belief. And so we've just got almost everything, you know, is pretty much that. Sorry, guys.
Wow. But yeah. So is that a good argument for me to get a motorcycle with a sidecar for the kids?
Yeah, you should tell your wife that that's exactly my recommendation, that you Katie should Bowman all have a motorcycle. That's right.
Because Nikki's basically been like, yeah, you get a motorcycle and you wake up with your testicles in your mouth. So, yeah.
Wow, she's a godfather on you right there.
She's Italian, so yeah.
Oh, I mean, makes sense. Yeah.
Gosh, that is so, you know, it. We talked about this on the last show where it's just... validating on the one hand, horrifying on the other hand, because so much of where we've gone wrong with food, you know, it's again, like if the only, I'm just bouncing around here, but I had a boss who was really, really smart. This guy was very successful in business, but he was born and raised in Southern California, lived around the Long Beach area. And we were driving around one day and we were just talking about like farming and sustainability and whatnot. And he just looked at me, he's like, so this is going to sound really stupid, but like vegetables grow in the dirt, right? And I just looked at him, I'm like, yeah, man, like where else are they going to grow? Like out of your ear? And he's like, no, it's just weird. You know, like I'm a city kid and I just don't get it. And so we actually drove out at, you know, there was some farm outside of like Huntington Beach and he was like poking around and he pulled a carrot out of the ground and he's like, this just seems so dirty, you know? And I'm like, yeah, man, it grows in the dirt. And you know, and so there's this huge disconnect with food, clearly, where folks think that food is just a horrifying array of things. But the layer of movement, and then even thinking about, you know, like horizon deprivation and stuff like that, it just seems so much larger and so much even more entrenched and not on folks' radar. And it's been interesting. The talks that I give for corporate folks in particular, I actually start the whole talk off with the movement piece and kind of the, you know, the hunter-gatherer exercise kind of notion. Because interestingly, people seem a little bit more open to that, but yet I think that there's even more blind spots there than even what I was aware of, particularly before reading your book. Like there are so many blind spots there, but yet it oftentimes is a more palatable place to start the conversation relative to jumping in and talking about food and photo period and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, it really has nothing to do with smart or stupid. It's not smart or stupid. It's not even educated or uneducated. It just has to do with your cultural experience right to date. It's just that. And I've met a ton. I mean, I would say that most people doing clinical research are very well educated. So it's not about education, but yet for some reason, almost every bit of research done on the human comes from the United States, was on this was on us and really was on people who were at college, right? That's your, for the most people, right. For the most part, that your data collection is being done by people willing in your own department to participate in your study. For the most part, that's where a lot of it is done, but it's certainly done on the population that is around you, meaning most studies done in America are done on Americans. Yet in all of this research on baby, here's what babies need. Here's all the baby reflexes, and here's how they were just vestigular, and here's how they went away until their brains really developed. And women's pelvis have grown wide because, you know, heads are too big, and our brains are just, like, all this crazy stuff just has perpetuated because no one thought that what we were doing in America was any different than what human beings do all over the world. And so you have this whole body of peer-reviewed literature. It's peer-reviewed, it's published, the data is all there. The data is not false. It's just that the data pertains to a very narrow population void of lots of input and suffering from huge amounts of certain inputs. And they're just now starting to recognize that really understanding anatomy by studying Americans over the last 80 years probably wasn't the best way of
to go.
Yes, or writing. I mean, it's okay to write a textbook of here is the body of the modern American, which is what the textbook should say. But what it says is human anatomy and physiology. No, that's not human anatomy and physiology. This is the American body. So there's a really great article on how all of that understanding is now having to be redone because of the way they phrase it was researchers were doing the equivalent of studying penguins and believed they were studying birds. And that's how it was framed. But here's the thing, when you go do a PubMed or a Google Scholar review, no one flags the articles that have since been modified, or it's like, hey, it turns out that method wasn't a good one or some critical piece. So you could be reading literature that is peer reviewed in there and everything here, there, everywhere, but it's not actually, it wouldn't be valid by taking it into a slightly different context. And so
we see that with blood work all the time.
Sure.
You know, in our clinic, what we consider to be normal blood work, we're taking some our best guess at some anthropological parameters, looking at the Hadza, looking at as many kind of pre-agricultural groups as we can track down, some pre-industrialized groups, and using that more as our baseline. And what we find is, and also even talking to the testing labs, what they report as normal has changed dramatically over time because they're just kind of moving the benchmarks further, because what is normally showing up in a doctor's office is more and more pathogenic. And so you put your goalposts in at these arbitrary points, but they're very, very different than what we look at as being normal blood glucose levels, insulin levels, systemic inflammatory levels. But yet it's still in the literature, what's considered kind of normal and I guess therefore okay is very, very different than what we are looking at.
Well, you just always have to check, like, consider the source. Like, those goalposts are put in there for insurance purposes. It's like, when do I call this a diagnosis? It's like, well, right. If you track someone over 15 years, did you see it change? Like, in math, right? In science, you're always looking for deltas. You're looking for any change, because everyone has, like, their own particular baseline. And then there are, you know, broader baselines that go for different people at different times in their life, et cetera. But health, biological health and medical health are, again, two different categories. And so you're like looking at biology and then someone else is looking at medicine. And so when you're reading literature, you just have to kind of go, well, what is this person looking for? This person is looking for risk for death. This person is looking for interventions, cost of interventions, period over a life. It'll have to be paying for interventions. And so all of your data is going to be skewed to the person trying to come up with the solution for it. And so I think that a lot of people don't understand that with quote science. I'm beginning to not even like the term science, because that people just use it as a noun and a verb and an adjective and a curse word. You know, you can use it for all kinds of things, but It's like you have to consider the source. There's just a method. It's just a method. So you have to do the work when you're reading it to figure out. You have to read the context. You can't take it out of context. You have to read all 7,000 articles to get the context and figure out what someone is after. So anyway, that's where we are right now. Science.
Science. Where's that going to get you? Just heartache and suffering, I tell you.
I love it. And dates, lots of dates on Friday night. Science right. will get you dates.
Oh, totally. Well, I did. Yeah, that's a topic for a different discussion. But I wanted to pester you about one other thing. We're getting tight on time, but you have one chapter, Your Feet Sitting and Standing. When you were on the first show, you were able to unpack the news piece that was talking about like the Vibram shoes and some barefoot running. And I think you have a new product out also that talks about transitioning more to barefoot activities. Maybe you could talk about that. But the thing that I have with Zoe, we started her barefoot as much as possible. The main shoe, you know, quote, shoe that she wore was this kind of moccasin type thing that was literally just like a flap of leather around her foot, and she seemed to do pretty well with that. But now she's at an age where it's really hard to find something that is legitimately, you know, minimalist in shoe. We just try to keep her out of shoes for the most part, and we run around in the backyard barefoot, and we get stickers and rocks and all kinds of stuff. But do you have a recommendation along that line? Is, you know, as the kid, it seems like there's a gap from about like 2.5 or 3 years old up until about 5 years old, where you have some good kind of minimalist shoe options. Like, how do you navigate that?
Well, I live in the Pacific Northwest, where we get a little bit more weather. And so we do barefoot as much as possible, unless weather doesn't allow. And keeping in mind that we'll even do barefoot in bad weather, just not for extended periods of time. So I use Softstar. Are you familiar with Softstar shoes?
No.
So Softstar is kind of my go-to kid, because they're just leather. There's no rise, there's no sole, there's no nothing. And you can pick the style or the design that works best for the shape of the foot or the season or whatever you want. So we've fared really well with those. A lot of parents are, foot development is huge, right? So my first book was on feet, and I do have another transitioning to minimal footwear, a more robust argument than it's natural you should do it. You know, like a really robust evaluation of both sides, considering terrain, right? Is it really full sense to go barefoot, but then overtake, you know, input of vitamin flat and level? You know, have shoes actually been protecting us because we're over consuming flat and level? These are questions, so you have to think about, you can't just look at the biomechanics of the foot. You have to think about, well, what's the relationship of the foot moving through the environment? What are the essential nutrients we still might be missing just because we have minimal shoes on? But anyway, with kids, foot, you know, everyone's concerned. It's like, my kids' feet are turning out, their arches are flat, they're, you know, what do we do? The foot, a lot of the foot structure is maintained by the hip. So again, full development really includes minimal chair sitting. So that's why we axed all the furniture in our house. Seriously, we have no furniture in our house, because I kind of consider, I mean, we have furniture. We just don't have stuff to sit on. We don't have couches. So my kids have never really sat on furniture for eating or for any other time, you know, just like treats that they get in other people's house. When they go to other people's house, they're like, look at this chair. This chair is awesome. So I don't mind that. It's just that it's like junk food for the body. So I don't keep it in the house so that they don't over consume it. So when the kids are not taught how to sit, you're essentially teaching them how to sit by modeling sitting and then providing tons of stuff for them to sit. It's the 90 degree knee and hip that eventually collapses the foot. It's the lack of the hip and the foot hinging and working together, getting up and down out of the squatting position, sitting on the floor, cross-legged, straight-legged, wide-legged, all the different ways that kids sit and that people would be sitting, you know, were there not all this furniture, that really go into strong and healthy feet, that the feet don't live in a vacuum. They're really a whole body phenomenon. So if you're noticing that your kids' feet are doing something that you don't think they should do, first, don't panic. You might not know what they're supposed to do. It's perfectly okay for them to go. They don't, like, you don't come out with baby arches you know, and then lose them. They're developed, but they're developed through this really robust way of moving through the hip and through the knee and walking over terrain, etc.
Interesting. Holy smoke. So I need to take my couch and huck it off the back patio.
Yeah. You can.
That could save a lot of money. Like decorating the house is going to be really inexpensive now.
Well, I mean, certainly. And we have monkey bar. Like, we've replaced stuff. I have a tour of my house so people can see. It's like not as, it's not as freaky as it sounds. It's just, we have floor cushions. It's also, I mean, it's the way that most of the world actually lives. Again, it's the weird anomaly to have furniture.
All that gear. Right. Yeah. Oh man, Katie, we're kind of short on time. I don't want to totally capitalize your day. Like I said, I could have spent 2 hours just on chapter one, just with questions that I had. But before we started recording, I kind of threw out the possibility that maybe folks following the podcast, following the blog, maybe we could do kind of a book club and work our way a chapter a week through this. And then maybe at the end of the month, we could pull Katie in either on the forum or maybe a quick podcast just to answer some questions. Just throwing that out to folks. We'll see what type of interest there is. And if we have some good interest, and Katie, if you're game for that, then maybe we can circle back around and work through this stuff. If there's not enough interest, then people will just suffer with their bad hips and pelvi, and they'll be smitten from above for not seeing the wisdom of that idea. But I'm really excited about that as a potentiality. Katie, remind folks where to track you down and what stuff you have going on.
You can always find me at restorativeexercise.com, and that will take you to any possible way besides, you know, my home address. You can get a hold of me through that website. You can there's social media pages where I'm on every day doing Q&A, and you can find so many articles and a way just to read more through restorativeexercise.com. Best way.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you so much for coming on again. Thank you for writing really an amazing book. Like the folks that I have on the podcast, I try to actually make it, if they have books, it's actually a book that I want to read instead of just a mill of stuff to pump through for content. And that said, this has been the most enjoyable book I've read in ages, and I've read it twice. I'm getting ready to read it again. I have the thing is just riddled with notes in the margins and underlining and whatnot, which I actually do very, very little of that. And so I think that speaks, at least from my perspective, testament to what a wonderful book this is, how valuable it is. And I look forward to getting you back on the show whenever you're ready to come on.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you. And anytime.
Thank you, Katie. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.